The Universe Next Door. That's the primary textbook. And so you'll have to try, and it's pretty easy to get this book. You can get it through Barnes & Noble. You can get it through, get a real good deal through Christian book distributors. Maybe you might want to order it together as a group because you'll still have to pay the shipping and handling. But you can get like Overnight Express, and if you've got seven or eight people ordering the book all at once, the cost won't be too bad. But it's The Universe Next Door by James Sire, published by InterVarsity Press. And that's going to be the primary text. What I like about how Sire deals with worldviews is that he not only handles it from the aspect of, what is the rational, what's a rational exposition of this particular worldview, and how do we Christians refute it, but he also comes at it from a historical standpoint. So in his textbook, the first worldview that he mentions is the Christian worldview, Christian theism, okay? And that's because the Christian worldview was the dominant worldview of Western civilization, since the 4th century A.D. And so he starts there, and then as time went on, deism held the primary position, and then eventually it was secular humanism or atheism, and now we're moving into neo-pagan type thought and postmodern thought. And so he handles it as a, comes at it from a historical perspective as well as a rational philosophical angle. Now, if you look at the worldviews, I'll just read the course description. As Dr. Francis Schaeffer has stated, we live in a post-Christian era. Christian worldview no longer dominates the thought of our culture. Therefore, Christians must learn about other worldviews as well as the Christian worldview if we are to effectively dialogue with people of other faiths. Through this course, students will explore the various worldviews that have won the allegiance of many throughout history. Special attention will be given to the defense of the Christian worldview. The dates on this outline obviously don't apply. It was when I taught this course at an earlier time. But if you turn the page, you'll see the course outline. Due to time limitations, we're probably not going to be able to cover everything on this list. But just to give you a basic overview, we'll introduce the subject. We'll talk about what exactly a worldview is. We'll try to define what a worldview is. We'll talk about how we test worldviews. Then we'll talk about, different worldviews. We'll get into Christian theism, how it differs from Jewish or Islamic theism. We'll talk about deism, atheism, pantheism, both the Eastern and the Western versions of that, and then modernism, postmodernism, and there will be an exam. I don't know if we're going to have time to take the exam here. It might be a take-home exam. If you go back to the first page, you'll see the assignments. There's a 5 to 8 page paper, double-spaced, that discusses a non-Christian worldview and, critiques it from a Christian perspective. You also have to write a one-page summary of each chapter from James Sire's book, The Universe Next Door. A one-page critique of a magazine article, book, television show, or movie that promotes a non-Christian worldview. And then you have to attend the lectures take notes, participate in the discussion, and then pass the final exam. But let me say this. If you're going for the A+, you have to, it's going to take both quantity and quality. You've got to get all of this. But if you look at your schedule and it's not going to work, it's just a 2-credit course, if something has to give and you cannot do all of these assignments, you know, you're going to have to do the 5 to 8 page paper. But basically what I'm getting at, you can still come out of this with a good solid B and miss one of the assignments. But make sure you do the 5 to 8 page paper and the final exam. Those are the two that you have to do. At the same time, this is 2 credits. So, and I believe I designed this for a 4-credit course. And so, if you find that it's a little bit too much, do the best you can, but make sure you get that paper in and make sure you take the exam. If the exam is take-home, you know, if we don't have time to just devote that last week to the exam, if the exam is take-home, you know, do it within a week or two. Because if you don't do it within a week or two and you think, well, I'm not ready, I might only get a B, you know, if you're going to wait 3 or 4 weeks, it's probably not going to get done. You know, just make sure you work on that. I've given you a bibliography that's for your own free time. You can look at some different books there that might help in your study of worldviews. And if you then just turn right after the page, right after the bibliographies, we'll get started with the introduction. Now, first, before studying worldviews, obviously, we have to define what we mean by a worldview. And here's an abridged version of what Sayer writes on page 16 of his work, The Universe Next Door. A worldview is a set of presuppositions. Worldview is a set of presuppositions which we hold. The worldview is a set of presuppositions which we hold about the basic makeup of our world. A worldview is a set of presuppositions which we hold about the basic makeup of our world. Now, A worldview is the way you view a person views the world. Okay, so this is simple stuff. It doesn't have to be complex. It's a way a person views reality. Okay, now just to let you know, we're doing a course right now in worldviews. What's the difference between that and world religions? And, you know, I've taught courses on world religions before. It's pretty much if we draw here 4 circles, okay, and on the outside you have a person's behavior or their practices, you know, what they do. Well, that's often the way people behave is often due to their beliefs, okay? And sometimes we hear about people and they have really strange beliefs that that don't make much sense to us. And sometimes it's because those beliefs are based upon a different religion, okay? When we are talking worldviews, and this is not meant as a slam on religion in any way, shape, or form, but when we are talking about worldviews, we're talking about something that is deeper than a person's religion. Okay? So the inner circle would be the worldview, and then the next circle would be the person's religion. Then the next circle, their beliefs, and the final circle, their behavior. Okay? And the reason why I'm saying this is theism. We're going to learn that theism is the belief in a personal God. belief that a personal God exists. Okay? And so, you have many people who are theists. But can anybody tell me the three main theistic religions? Well, that's actually, it has the word theism in there, is the word theism for God, but it's really weird, and I don't know why they made it that way, but a polytheist isn't really a theist. And so, we'll get to that later, but there's three theistic religions, and what'd you say? Not Buddhism, but it's basically Christianity. We believe in the existence of a personal God. So there's Christianity. The Islamic faith. Islam. And Judaism. Sometimes they're called the Western religions. Set them apart from the Eastern religions like Buddhism or Hinduism. Okay? So, Christians are theists, Muslims are theists, and Jews are theists. So you can see with a worldview, you know, being a theist, it's even deeper than one's religion because there's different types of theists. Okay? So it's even more foundational. In other words, when a person says they're a theist, you can ask them, well, what kind of theist? So, you know, because if we're looking at the theistic worldview in this realm of religion here, you'd have all three of these, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. So we're looking at the core beliefs that even, you know, we're narrowing down the core beliefs and the presuppositions that a person has. It's becoming even more narrow. Our focus is even more narrow than it would be when we're dealing with world religions. Now, we will talk a little bit about world religions in this course, because, you know, we're Christian theists. And why are we Christian theists as opposed to Islamic theists or Jewish theists? Okay? And so that question will come up. Basically, if you want a simple definition of worldview, even simpler than that given by James Sire, the author of our textbook, a worldview is the way a person views reality. Okay? The way a person views reality. Now, on pages 17 and 18 of Sire, by the way, I don't teach the textbook in this course, but there's some foundational issues that I think are real important from Sire. I kind of use that as a launch pad. And then there's some parts of this course that have nothing to do with Sire's book, but have a lot to do with worldview. So there's going to be I'm going to be on the same sheet of music with them, and other times I'll go off in a different direction. I think he's great, James Sire, great thinker. So anytime I depart from him, it's in matters of focus or emphasis. It's not really in any disagreement with him. It's one of the I wouldn't say that about a lot of Christian authors, but James Sire is really, really sharp. But the seven basic questions that James Sire thinks that we should ask whenever dealing with worldviews and the first one is, what is prime reality? What is prime reality? In other words, different worldviews are going to answer these questions in different ways. Okay? So what is prime reality? In other words, what is the really real? What is ultimate reality? Is there a God? Or maybe there's many gods. Or maybe all that exists is the universe. Okay? So what is prime reality? In other words, what is the most important reality from which anything else that we call real comes from? Okay? So you're looking at the question of whether God exists or there's more than one God. And then what is the nature of external reality? The world outside our minds, the world that supposedly exists outside our mind. Is it real? Does a world really exist outside our mind? If it does, is it created or is it uncreated? Is it did it have a beginning or did it always exist? Is it chaotic or is it orderly? Is it matter or is it spirit? I mean, there are some worldviews. A consistent pantheistic worldview would argue that the physical universe ultimately is an illusion. Okay, so which is really interesting. That's going a little bit ahead of ourselves, but most pantheists believe in reincarnation, which is a person's individual soul has to be reincarnated in another body after death. And it goes on and on until you escape reincarnation. But a consistent pantheist, there's no room for a physical universe and for physical bodies, and there's no room for individual souls. And so reality is one. So it's really weird. Reincarnation actually contradicts pantheism, yet most pantheists do hold to reincarnation. If they deny the existence of individual souls and physical bodies, but both are needed if reincarnation is true. But whatever the case, how do we, in the Christian worldview, the external world is really real. Because God really did create it. There really is a physical world outside of our minds. Okay, the third question, what is a human being? What is a human being? Is a human being a machine? Is a human being mere molecules in motion? Okay, that's what the atheistic worldview would seem to imply. A highly evolved animal? Or is a human being a god? Or is a human being God, like Shirley MacLaine thinks, a New Age pantheist? Or is a human being, was a human being created in God's image? So, depending on the worldview, we would have different answers to that question. Number four, what happens to a person at death? So I'll just put after death question mark. What happens to a person at death or after death? Is there life after death? What about reincarnation? Or maybe we just cease to exist after death. Number five, is knowledge possible? And if knowledge is possible, why is it possible? How can man know? Now, this is where I think the Christian worldview is on such firm ground. And for that matter, in this particular area, the Islamic religion and Judaism would also be on firm ground. Because, those who deny, a person could deny, okay, well, maybe we can't know anything because there is no absolute truth. There's nothing that is true for all people at all times and all places. Okay? The problem with that statement statement, there is no absolute truth, okay, is a claim that statement is true. It's a truth claim. In other words, the only way the statement there is no absolute truth could be true would be if it were an absolute truth, but then it would have to be false. And so it's what philosophers call a self-refuting statement. So in other words, there has to be absolute truth. And you get outside of theism, especially in pantheistic circles, and even in consistent atheistic circles, there's a denial of truth. But the denial of truth is self-refuting. It doesn't hold any water. And, you know, people might say, okay, maybe absolute truth exists, but man can't know it. What's the problem there? If somebody claims, well, man cannot know truth, well, then we would know that truth, at least. Okay? So, if man couldn't know truth, then man couldn't know the truth, that man couldn't know truth. So basically, if there's two things we could be positive of, number one, there is absolute truth, and number two, it is possible for man to know it. But not all worldviews would agree with that. And, you know, so some worldviews would argue that knowledge is impossible, there's no such thing as truth, and then they'll write, you know, 600-page books to try to teach you their truths, that there are no truth. Try to get you to attain not the knowledge that man can attain no knowledge. And some of these guys are on the bestsellers list, so it's really amazing. But it goes back to Romans 1, where Paul says that mankind has no excuse for rejecting the existence of the invisible God, has no excuse for rejecting the existence of the Creator, because God has made, through His creation, He has made His existence evident to us. But what we do is we suppress that truth, and then we profess to be wise, but we speculate and we make fools out of ourselves. And that's what's happening. It's kind of, ultimately, if you reject the true God, you will wallow in the pits of foolishness, whether you like it or not. You can claim to be wise, but basically you're going to be proclaiming and believing fairy tales. But why is it possible to know anything at all? Some would say, well, because we were created by a rational God. You know, the theist would say, we were created by a rational God who created us in His image, and then created an orderly universe so that through reason we could find out about this orderly universe in which we live, and we could find out about God because He's revealed Himself to us. So a rational creation would be one explanation. You know, maybe the atheist wants to go the route and say, well, it's possible to know things because we've evolved the ability to know things. Now, you know, I wish an atheist would throw a premise like that at me in a debate. And I mean, it is so hard when you reject the existence of a personal, rational God, when you reject the existence of the infinite, rational, personal God of the Scriptures, it is so tough. I mean, everything else goes with it. I mean, Friedrich Nietzsche, the German atheist, he argued if God is dead, morality has died with Him, truth has died with Him, and meaning has died with Him. What Nietzsche is basically saying to his colleagues, his atheist colleagues, is that, look, we threw God off the bridge. We taught people and told people that Christianity is a fairy tale. We threw God off the bridge, but before we threw Him off the bridge, we went through His pockets. And we pulled out absolute truth, and we pulled out moral values, and we pulled out meaning in life. And he said, and Nietzsche's arguing, we had no right to do that. If we throw God off the bridge, truth goes off the bridge with Him, morality goes off the bridge with Him, meaning in life goes off the grid. That's why Nietzsche described the death of God as detaching the earth from its sun. You know, he said there's no longer any up or down anymore. It's like man is standing at the edge of a cliff, and you take one more step, and you're just standing there in the air, and there's nothing holding you up. And then Nietzsche argued, we've got to have something to sustain us. We've got to have some values. So he said, when once reason is thrown out the window, all that's left is man's will to power. And so he was hoping for a group of supermen to arrive on the scene, the overmen, with the courage through their will to power to create their own hard values, because he believed that the soft values of Christianity were holding back human progress and human evolution. Whatever the case, I debated Dan Barker. It is so tough to hold on to reason and truth when you throw out the personal God. See, the reason why it's so easy to reject God in our society is because people in our society don't care about being reasonable. It's like, you know, contradictions, I can live with them, man. No problem. But with Dan Barker, when I debated him at Bellevue Community College, I asked him, how much does a thought weigh? Okay, and he said, you can weigh a thought. And I said, well, are you saying that a thought or a decision or a choice that a person makes is nothing but a chemical exchange that occurs inside somebody's brain? And he said, exactly. See, he was consistent with his atheism. Okay? And then I slammed him because he kept bringing up Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bombing, as evidence that God doesn't exist because he said God wouldn't allow it and that type of thing. And of course, the Christian response is that God allows evil and human suffering for purposes of a greater good, and we don't always know what that greater good may be in a particular case. But basically, I responded to Dan Barker, well, why are you so hard on Timothy McVeigh when he was just responding to a brain squirt? Because if there's not an immaterial soul, an immaterial self that makes the decision, that makes the choice, which then acts upon our brains, okay, then Timothy McVeigh and Adolf Hitler, for that matter, would be no more responsible for their decisions and their actions than you would be if you came down with the cold. I mean, everything becomes biological. And you know, Timothy McVeigh has no say over what kind of chemical reactions are going on in his brain if he has no immaterial soul. But most atheists are not willing to be as consistent as Dan Barker. They'll say you can't weigh a thought, you know, and they'll acknowledge that it's immaterial. But then the problem for atheism is, well, if you reject the existence of the invisible God, don't things like immaterial thoughts and ideas, invisible things that you cannot sense, isn't that excess baggage to your worldview, having this invisible furniture in the atheistic worldview? It really doesn't fit. It's not a good fit. Now, if you acknowledge the existence of an invisible God, then invisible concepts, invisible truths, invisible things like love, moral values, laws of logic, then there's really no problem with them existing. So, is knowledge possible? You know, and the thing is, suppose they say, okay, knowledge is not possible. And how do you defend your worldview? So if a person has a worldview where knowledge is not possible, you know, then it's not possible to defend their worldview. End of discussion. Okay? But, you know, most people who would acknowledge that they hold to a worldview would admit that knowledge is possible, well, then the question is, okay, well, then why is knowledge possible? If an atheist says that knowledge is possible, why? Given your atheism, why is knowledge possible? Okay, if we're just nothing but an accidental throwing together of atoms, what makes us think that human consciousness does arrive at truth every now and then? And how could there even be such a thing as truth? Question number six, how do we know what is right and wrong? So it deals with questions of morality. How do we know what is right and wrong? Each worldview has to deal with these questions. And how they answer, how these questions are answered, will go a long way to determining, you know, for to help us to identify what worldview what worldview the person holds. And then number seven, what is the meaning of human history? So the meaning of history. A lot of different answers here. In Christianity, history is linear. That means it starts somewhere and it's going in a direction. It's going to have a climax, an ending of history, if you will. Like in the Christian worldview, is kind of the second coming of Jesus Christ to the planet Earth and his reign on Earth. The cyclical view with reincarnation, you just keep going around in circles. That's held by the Eastern pantheists, the Hindus, the Buddhists, even many Americans now in the New Age movement are holding to the cyclical view. Friedrich Nietzsche held to a cyclical view, eternal recurrence. He believed that there was a finite number of atoms. But he believed the universe was eternal, so a limited number of atoms, but an unlimited amount of time. So given enough time, all the atoms in the universe will be reshuffled and in the same place that they are right now. Which means if Friedrich Nietzsche is correct, if he is correct, you are damned to return an infinite number of times to this course, over and over and over and over again. So that's probably the clearest cyclical view of history. Gordon Clark referred to it as Nietzsche's eternal merry-go-round. You just go around and around in circles, over and over again. Okay, any questions? Any questions about those questions? Okay, now we want to look at how do we test worldviews. Sire, on pages 196 and 197, he gives us four answers there. I group a couple of his together, so let me just give you the three that I would give. Number one is internal consistency. Internal consistency. You know, if a worldview, let me ask you this: if somebody's worldview, okay, has contradictions on this level, the behavior level, does that mean the worldview is false? No, not necessarily. In other words, you could have a Christian who has the Christian worldview and it's not living consistently with it, okay? So we're not talking about peripheral contradictions. Even in the realm of beliefs, a person could have the true religion, the Christian religion, and they could have some fault, misinterpret the scriptures, okay, and come up with some weird heretical beliefs. That doesn't mean the Christian worldview is false. But what I'm talking about is at the core of a worldview, if it has contradictions, okay, then it's got to be false. Okay, so with pantheism, with the a pantheist believes, pantheist is a monist. Okay, monism teaches all reality is one. Okay, a monist teaches all reality is one. Well, a pantheist is a monist who calls this reality God. So pantheist says God is everything. God is the world. God is the universe. Okay? So in the pantheist way of thinking, ultimately, only one soul exists, the world soul. Okay? So ultimately, only one mind exists. So whenever a pantheist tries to convince you to become a pantheist, okay, that is one mind trying to convince another mind that only one mind exists. Okay? Those are the kinds of contradictions that I'm talking about. Okay? When you have a worldview that is not internally consistent on its core beliefs, its core presuppositions, okay, its core assumptions, then it's time to find a new worldview. Okay? With atheism, I think consistent atheism has to deny absolute truth. But then that means that atheism could never be true. Okay? The problem is that most atheists are either not consistent atheists, or they're consistent atheists, but they won't acknowledge, they just refuse to acknowledge the logical consequences of their views. Okay? So they'll still deny, so the consistent atheist will deny truth, but will still act like atheism is true and there are truths we have to uphold. Okay? But I think with a real consistent atheism which denies truth, then the statement God exists is no more true or false than the statement God does not exist. And as far as I'm concerned, that's not a real attractive worldview. So testing worldviews, the internal consistency, okay, if it's contradictory at its core beliefs, it needs to be rejected. Number two, explanatory power, or you could call it explanatory adequacy. Explanatory power or explanatory adequacy. We look inside. Is this worldview internally consistent? And then if it is, it's not contradictory, well, how does it explain, you know, the world outside of the mind? And does it really explain things, or does it, you know, sweep things under the rug? You know, how do you explain the existence of this chair? Okay? If Eastern pantheism is true, that chair is not ultimately real. In fact, the whole physical universe is an illusion. But the pantheist can't live that way. Anybody who believes the physical universe is an illusion and tries to live consistently with that will cease to eat food. And then you'll die. So it is, you can't live consistently with it, which, by the way, is the third point. But whatever the case, to me, that is not an adequate explanation of the existence of this chair to say that it's an illusion. Okay? the atheist would agree with the theist. Okay, the chair really is there because matter is real. Matter really does exist, and it's a product of intelligent design. But then we can start pushing the question back further, and, you know, how can the chair be a product of intelligent design, a simple chair, when the highly complex human, most complex thing we know of in the universe is the human brain, yet we weren't designed? We're not a product of intelligent design? And my way of thinking, if I'm not a product of intelligent design, then ultimately any of my inventions are also not products of intelligent design. Because eventually you come back to a non-rational premise, i.e. me. If I got here through accident, then anything else that comes from me is going to be in the accident category, not the intelligent design category. So at first, atheism seems to have as good an explanation of the chair as theism, until you realize that they've got to explain the chair maker. And if the chair needs an intelligent designer, then why not the chair maker? Explanatory power or explanatory adequacy. And then number three, experiential relevance. Experiential relevance. Now, experiential relevance, you know, can cover a lot of things. Our moral experience, does it explain our moral experience? You know, I mean, when I debated Dan Barker, I asked him, rape and incest, are they wrong at all times, in all places, for all people? And he's a consistent atheist, so he said no. And that alone is good enough reason for me to reject atheism. Okay? It's amazing, too. The atheist will say, look at the Holocaust, how evil it was, and then they'll argue against God's existence on Monday, but on Tuesday they're arguing there's no such thing as evil. So maybe we Christians can't fully solve the problem of evil. Maybe we only have some of the answers. You know, the only one who can fully solve the problem of evil, knows all the answers, is God. If you think you got God all figured out, you have all the answers, your God's too small. He's not the God of the Bible. And then, by the way, that's the strongest argument for atheism when it comes down to it. The strongest argument for atheism, and it comes in different shapes or forms, but it always comes down to this. If your God exists, then you have to explain to me every reason why he allowed every case of evil and human suffering. And that doesn't follow at all. If my God exists, since God is an infinite God, I'm not going to be able to explain all these. And so basically the atheist says, the God of the Bible has answered 95% of the big questions that we human beings ask. What the atheist does, he focuses on the 5% that God hasn't answered. Okay? And keep in mind, there's an infinite number of questions we're not even smart enough to ask. Okay? But the atheist is saying, because God hasn't answered the 5% of those of the big questions, you should reject Christianity and become an atheist. Which, when everything is said and done, atheism answers 0%. I mean, they present answers, but I think just like the chair, ultimately those answers are not really adequate answers at all. So with experiential relevance, it could be in areas of morality, meaning in life. Okay. You know, if atheism is true and after you die you cease to exist, then why even get up in the morning? What makes life meaningful? And, you know, Michael Martin, one of America's leading atheists, over and over again, he says in that debate that, well, he can make meaning for his life, or there's meaning for his life, but it's always man-made meaning. You know, hey, you can worship, you can go out and buy a Corvette and worship it all you want. That really doesn't bring any ultimate meaning to life. And that's what philosophers call the argument for God's existence from the absurdity of life without God. Okay? The oldest form of the argument for God's existence from the absurdity of life without God I would argue it's Ecclesiastes, written by Solomon, where he says everything under the sun is futile, is vanity. Okay? And then he basically, at the end, you know, after saying everything under the sun, no matter what it is, whether it's building projects or